This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Welcome back to Entree Architect Podcast. Today, we are joined by Jane Frederick, FAIA. Jane is a principal at Frederick & Frederick Architects in Beaufort, South Carolina, where her firm specializes in sustainable custom residences. She served as the 2020 National President of the American Institute of Architects and has been recognized with AIA South Carolina's Medal of Distinction and the AIA South Carolina Firm Award. Jane is also co-author of Contemporary Southern Vernacular, Creating Sustainable Houses in Hot, Humid Climates, which we're going to talk about today. She brings decades of leadership, design excellence, and dedication to the architectural profession. She's one of us. She is a small firm entrepreneur architect, and I am proud and excited to welcome her to the podcast. Jane Frederick, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much, Mark. I'm looking forward to our conversation today. I know it's going to be a lot of fun.
Me too. I am looking forward to this very much. I can't believe that we haven't talked before now.
I know, especially if you're in Charlotte. That's not that far away.
Yeah, well, I've been in Charlotte since 2019, but I've been podcasting a long time, and I've talked to many leaders at AIA, but I've never spoken to you. So I'm really excited to have you on the show here today.
Well, you know, I was president in 2020, so that was kind of an odd year.
Yeah, it was an odd year. And that was the year that I moved. I moved the summer of 2019 to Charlotte. And everybody knows what happened in 2020, right after I moved. And when you became president, we had a little friend called COVID show up and throw everybody off the rails. And so I'm sure that is a great podcast episode as well. I'd love to have that conversation someday on how you handled that, because you did a fantastic job. That was a very difficult situation. But that's not what we're here today to talk about. Today, we're here to talk about you. I want to start with your origin story. So go back as far as you want to go back. Share your story to how you got started, who inspired you to get started, when did you discover your passion for architecture, and share that up to where you are today.
Thanks, Mark. So really, I was encouraged to study architecture by my high school art teacher, and I think a lot of people might have been encouraged by some of the teachers early on. My father was an aerospace engineer, and my mother was a decorator, so it kind of had the skill background to go into architecture. But really, the story that I want to tell starts with my husband Michael and I, who's we met at Auburn, but we were living in Alexandria, Virginia, and he had promised me that we would move south, and so we had lived in D.C., and we moved over to Alexandria, and he said, okay, we've moved south, but that was not quite right.
Not what you expected.
Yeah, I grew up in Tennessee. So we came through Buford on vacation. Michael said, I could live here. And 3 months later, we lived here. We went home, sold our house. Michael had another partner in an architecture firm. He sold his business, and we moved to Buford.
When was that?
That was 1989. So a while ago, our kids were 1 and 3 at the time. So they were easy to move. And it was a good move. But it was one of the things that brought us to Buford. And if you've been here, it's just one of the most beautiful places in the world, just with the marshes and the live oaks and just how everything is so connected to the land. And once we were here, I grew up in the South and Michael has deep family roots in the South, that we really started exploring the local vernacular architecture, which we were enjoying. And so we had our firm, we were working. And like most small firms, when you first start, you take whatever comes in the door. You just need to do it. But then about early 2000, about 2000 or 2001, we decided that we really wanted to specialize in custom residential. That's what we enjoyed. That was the really fun projects in a small town that's has a lot of retirees moving here. So
yeah, great location for that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what we wanted. And we had two projects at the time that sort of changed the course of our practice. They were both on the front beach of Hilton Head. They were renovation projects. So this was 2000. They were built around 1980-ish. And one of them had the EIFS stucco on it.
Right.
And so we were just working with the homeowners to replace that and maybe do small projects. Well, when we pulled off all that EIFS, it was eaten up with mold, mildew, termites.
Yeah.
Grossness, you know, just horrible. And part of that was because of it wasn't detailed right, obviously.
Right.
And then we had another project at the same time, Front Beach Hilton Head, and the people wanted to just make a few changes to it. You know, not a big project. It was going to be a little small project, but there was some rot on the outside of that one too. So it had shingles on it. So when we pulled the shingles out, same thing, mold, mildew, termites, rot, grossness. And we're thinking these houses are just 20 years old. What is wrong? I mean, you know, they shouldn't be falling apart when they're just 20 years old. So we started doing research, and that's when we found Joe Steibick, the building science guru.
Yeah, he's been on the show.
Yeah, and he was just starting. It was about the time where he was working with Building America and the guides to building in the different climates came out.
Right.
And as he said, that all the building codes up until that time were designed for cold climates by cold weather chauvinists, is how he referred to them. So it was like we were just building completely wrong for our climate. So we started, you know, paying attention to what he was saying. And at the time, the building codes, you know, you had to have a vented attic. So you had to let all that hot, humid air come into your attic. You had to have a vented crawl space. So we started going to our local building officials and saying, no, we have to have a closed envelope. And we finally got them to let us do correctly before the building codes changed. So, you know, the building codes changed probably mid-2000s or something like that. So we started doing it right before the building codes actually caught up with what we should be doing. So that really sort of changed the trajectory of what we were doing, because it was, you have to pay attention to where you are. And then as we moved into the 2000s, we heard Ed Mazzaria speak, who you've probably had on the show also.
I have not had Ed, but I know of Ed.
Yeah. You know, he wrote that article in Metropolis magazine in, I'm going to say 2003, about architects pollute, and that we were a lot of the problems with, you know, carbon and we needed to do something about it. So that's when we started paying attention even more to not just making sure that our walls were right, but that the whole building was done correctly, which led us to the book that we wrote, because we started doing it as it should be done. And you bump up against sometimes contractors who say, oh, we've been doing it this way for 40 years and it works right. just fine. And it's like, well, I don't think so.
It's the way we've always done it.
Yeah, we've always done it this way. So it's perfect. Or clients that don't really understand what they should do. And in our climate, which is hot and humid, to get to be net zero, we have to have solar, you know, because that's, you just can't do it without solar. But what we also found is how you detail your building, how you orient your building, what your wall section looks like. Your clients are trusting you to do that right.
Right.
And so as architects, we have a lot of control over making sure that our buildings are sustainable and have a very light footprint on the environment. Because, I mean, I've never had a residential client say, now, can I see how you flash that window?
Right. You know,
they trust us. The only thing we have to then sell them is to do solar. And it's getting easier. I don't know quite where the tax credits are. I'm afraid that they've all gone away. But South Carolina does have tax credits, and we have net metering. And clients are seeing the payback is pretty quick. And they also, we're seeing, it's really fun that some of our clients will say, oh, our kids will really love that we're doing this, you know, that we have solar and we're going to be a net zero house. So attitudes are changing a lot, I think, which is fun.
Yeah. And the next generation is expecting that that's the way it's going to be done.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the book is called Contemporary Southern Vernacular, Creating Sustainable Houses for Hot, Humid Climates. I'm going to buy it because I'm in a hot, humid climate in Charlotte, North Carolina, and it will be a great document for us to review. Can you talk a little bit about the book and what is it and how it works?
Yeah. So how we have approached it is it's very much for clients or potential clients. For it's not just a deep dive in like the building America's own, like exactly what your wall section right. should look like. It's more for this is what you need to be informed to be able to talk to your architect or your builder intelligently. So we start out starting with Southern vernacular traditions, because those were developed over years before air conditioning. So people were figuring out how do we
right.
live in this hot, humid climate and be somewhat comfortable. And they came up with some commonalities. One, it's typically one room wide so that you have good cross ventilation. You have high ceilings so that the heat rises. You have a porch definitely on the southern side and maybe on all four sides or three sides. And you are raised up off the ground so you get better breezes up. You get off the damp ground and up out of the floodplain. So those are some of the common, but then different forms. You know, there's the I house, there's the dog trot, there's a Buford one is a T house, the Charleston single house. So, and then we talk about some of the ones in Louisiana, like the Creole cottage and the shotgun. So we talk about some of the different forms, but they have all those commonalities together. So that's sort of how you start. And if you start with those vernacular forms and principles, you get a head start on sustainability, because that's what they were doing before we had air conditioning.
Just instinctively.
Yeah. And houses built with those concepts can be either, I mean, if you go to Charleston, you can see a Charleston single house that is a mansion or one that's just a very modest four-room house. So, you know, the principles apply to whatever scale you're doing.
When you went through those different elements of the building, one of them was to raise it up off the ground in order to get it off the ground. Is there air under southern buildings, or is it a crawl space, or how is it typically done?
Okay. Historically, it was open. It might be some big arches You know, it might have a masonry foundation with big arches because it was possibly going to get wet. Now, if we do a crawl space, of course, we seal it because you don't want hot, humid air in there.
And is that what you typically do today is a crawl space?
Either we do a raised slab, so we don't have a crawl space at all because we have critters here that you kind of want to not have in your house. But we also, like if we're out on the beach, we do a raised, and then we insulate at the underside of the floor.
Right. So there's air under the building.
And that's completely open. So it depends on the site and the location of it, but that's what we do. So then, the other thing with the historic ones, how they were sited, of course, was extremely important because they sited it so that the skinny side of the one room house were on the east and the west side so that you wouldn't have the solar gain on both of those sides. So that's also very important. So if you start with those, and then we go into a lot about site design and, you know, do not cut your trees down in your yard because they cool your house off. You know,
that's happening a lot around here in Charlotte. All the trees are being cut down. Yep.
People are crazy about cutting down the trees. It's like, well, I'm worried it's going to fall on my house. And it's like, well, your house is going to be really hot if you cut down all your trees. But the site design, as everybody knows, is so important. I mean, that's everybody learns this in architecture school, but just how you approach it, how you site it, how you connect. What's really important in our climate, too, is connecting to nature. I don't know if you know or knew of Robert Marvin, who was a renowned landscape architect from this part of the country.
No, I don't.
He always talked about that our forefathers were out in the elements all day working. And so when they came home, they wanted to cocoon. And we're totally opposite. We tend to sit in front of a computer all day. And so when we're not working, we want to get out into nature. So how you can tie your house back into nature, and where we are, you know, it's so beautiful that you want to take advantage of the views. If you have a view, look at the trees. You know, we talk a lot about the Japanese concept of a borrowed view. You know, that long view that you don't have to maintain, you can just enjoy. So we go into a lot about site design and then a bit into more the nuts and bolts of the site analysis and the zoning, and just so people, you know, homeowners don't think about that a lot. You know, we had a client that had bought a house, he had bought a lot before we met him, and he couldn't put septic on it because the neighbor's wells were too close to the property line. So he ended up having to pay to move his neighbor's well so it could be 50 feet away from his septic. And we, unfortunately, we have a lot of septic here because we're on, Buford has 96 different islands, so people are spread out some. I mean, another time I was at a zoning meeting, and somebody came in and they were really upset they weren't our client. But it was like, they're building this apartment building across the street from this lot I just bought. And, you know, if they had gone down to the zoning department before they bought the lot, they would have known that it was in the works. So, you know, a lot of that stuff that people don't think about, which is so important, or that you have a lot that you don't think is buildable because there might be trees in the middle of it. And if you do a custom house, you can work around it, but you need to hire the right person that can work around it. So those are the first parts of the book, just sort of a general overview. And then we go into a high level of building science so that, you know, just that talking about, you know, your wall system, what it needs to look like, that you need to have a drainage plan. You need to keep water out. You need to have airspace so when the water gets in, because it's going to get in because we get 50 plus inches of rain a year, it can get out. You know, so talking about how you put your wall together, talking about, you know, what windows you need to buy here. And also, I think what's important about our book is there's a lot of books written for designing a sustainable house for cold climates, but not any for hot, humid. And they'll talk about things like, well, you really need to do a double stud wall for all that insulation. And I mean, for us, it's good, but you get a better return on your money if you buy the best windows you possibly can instead of a double stud wall and add more insulation, you know. So it's sort of that payback of how we design here as opposed to there. And if you're cold, you're doing little boxes. And here we want to, you know, be able to get the breeze and get the views through there. So we go into some of the building science about the wall systems and the roofs and foundations. And then we talk about the building systems that you have, you know. So we design all of our HVAC in-house. We started doing that probably about 8 years ago because we found that mechanical engineers are really not interested in doing single family residential work.
Right.
And contractors tend to oversize. So it doesn't run enough to get your humidity out. So to be able to correct size your system really makes a difference. And it helps a lot too, because, you know, we do everything in Revit. So we have a 3D model of all the ducts going through.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know where your ducts are going. It's not like you get to the house and it's like, oh, no, we didn't think about where that main duct line.
The contractors must love working with you.
Some do and some don't. I think there's two types of contractors. Right. Those that like to work with architects and those that don't.
Yes.
So
yes.
We try to stick with the ones that like to work with architects. And they really like, you know, we have with Revit, you put on your VR glasses and you can walk around inside. And the contractors love that too, you know, before we get started so they can understand what's going on. So we talk about systems and we talk about HVAC, we talk about lighting, plumbing, appliances, you know, just what you need to do on those. And then we go into resiliency, because that's one of the things here that's incredibly important, because we do have hurricanes, and how do you make sure that your house is prepared for it and that you can survive in your house afterwards if there's not power, you know, what you're doing. So we go into resiliency. Then we finish up with aging in place, because this is a single family custom house is a big investment, and it should be, hopefully, can last your lifetime. I mean, of course, people move for various reasons, but most of our clients, this is their forever home. They tend to be sort of pre-retirement age. So this is where they want to spend the last days of their life.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a bad place to spend the rest of your life.
No, not at all. I mean, people end up moving because then if they get too infirm, they want to go closer to where their kids are, you know,
right,
this or that. But
so what inspired you to write the book in the first place?
I think one is that there wasn't anything like it. And we wanted to be able to help people. You know, Michael and I Frederick and Frederick have been part of the AIA 2030 commitment for about 10 years now. Not that many small firm architects are participating in it. I think it grows every year, but we wanted to help other architects to say it's not that hard. You know, it seems a little daunting when you start doing it, but it's not that hard if we can do it. And we've met the goal when it was a 70% reduction. We almost met it the year when it switched to 80%. So we tend to be about between 80 and 90% reduction right now. It's kind of hard to get 100% totally off the grid, but we've done a few houses that have made it.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to rcat.com/Arcademy. That's ARCAT.com/ARCATEMY. That's ARCAT.com/Arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. How big is your firm?
There's five of us.
and this is more of a logistical question, a business question. You've been an advocate, you've been a leader through AIA from your regional all the way up through national. You're writing books, and you said you have children. How do you balance all of that? How do you get to the point where you can become AIA national president and run a firm and, you know, do all the things that you're trying to do?
Well, my daughters are 38 and 40 now.
Yes, but they weren't always 38 and 40.
Yeah, they're pretty easy now. So when they were little, I tended to work school hours when they were real small, which was really nice. Our house and our office is on the same piece of property.
Okay,
they're separate buildings.
Yeah.
So then when they got a little older, maybe, you know, 10, 12, I don't remember, I would work a full day, but we were still on the same piece of property. So it wasn't like they were just home alone.
So you designed a lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. So we really moved to Buford before there was that term work-life balance.
Right. Right.
I mean, but that's what we created.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Michael did the same thing because he would coach soccer. So, you know, in the afternoons, if we wanted to do soccer or Odyssey of the Mind or whatever, I was a Girl Scout leader. So when they were little, we did all that kind of stuff. I would say the stuff that I've been able to do leadership-wise, it's because we have a great team here. Michael is extremely supportive. People are consultants that we work with. Sometimes they're amazed that his billable hours that he does every month. So that frees me up to not quite have quite as many billable hours.
So you have a good team, but it also sounds like you're a good partner, that you complement one another, that the things that
we do
that you're good at and that he is good at complement one another.
Right. And then we have two other architects that work for us, and they've both been with us over 10 years. So they're very capable and don't need any hand-holding at all.
When you first launched the firm, it was just the two of you, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
When you first started growing, was that a difficult process to go from the two of you that had a very specific designed lifestyle to hiring people that are going to be part of your team?
No, our first hire was Robert Belamovitz. He had just graduated from College Station. And he was just brilliant and just fit right in. And it was a real easy transition. And that's back when we were doing, you know, our computers were 286s and we had big floppy drives and you had to pass them around. And the problem then is, you know, you would end up with a drawing that none of them were the most current. I don't know if you were working on computers back then because somebody moved something and then you'd save it and somebody had worked on it. And it was just like,
yes,
awful. So
it was a tough time. I graduated in 93. And so I was that generation that went from drafting boards to computers. And so we were the first ones on the computers.
Yeah, we started on computers when we opened in 1989. And then we started on...
Yeah, so very early.
We started on Revit in 2007.
Very early.
Yeah. It's good because I think a lot of people, particularly my age and maybe even your age, but definitely my age, since we didn't have computers at all in college, just never bothered to learn. And, you know, when 2008 hit, they were in big trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. My generation was the one that the computers were there, but it was an option.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
It was just after me that it became part of the curriculum, that the CAD class was an optional class that you could take.
Right.
So different times. And certainly the times that we're living in today are very different as well. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you talked about the inspiration for the book and why you created it and what's in it. Technically, how did you have the book published? Did you partner with a publishing house?
No, we worked with a group, Kevin Anderson Associates, which helped us keep on schedule and know what we needed to do and that kind of stuff. Had some editing help, had a writer that would assist us some. But then we wrote it completely. And then we started sending it out to publishers and we got two offers. So Schiffer, who's a small independent publisher, family owned out of Pennsylvania, they've been in business about 50 years and they're a traditional publisher. They offered to publish it. And then Oro Press, which is a hybrid type publisher, also offered. But with Oro, you have to pay them to publish it. And Schiffer they publish it and you get royalty. So it was an easy decision for us to make, is to go with the traditional publisher. And they also, so they were really easy to work with. So they took the manuscript, they did an edit, and then we talked about how we wanted it to look, and we sent them some books that we liked the layout of, and what, how we wanted it. We wanted it to be open, friendly, a lot of white space, so it wasn't so crowded
right.
looking. Yep. But they did the layout. But even all you have to do is, you know, you have to get permission from all your photographers that you have. And we've used several over the years. One thing that worked out well for us, one of our photographers, he retired 4 or 5 years ago. And when he retired, we bought the copyright from him. So we had all those. That was
easy.
That's
great. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you ever have the chance to do that, do it. Then two photographers that we've used the most other than that didn't charge us to use the photographs. So the majority of the photographs, we didn't have to do additional reimbursement for.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And then a couple of photographers, we had to pay a nominal amount, which wasn't bad. But you have to get their permissions. And then you have to get permission of all the clients whose projects are in your book. And then if you have any people that are shown up, you have to get permission right. from all of them.
Was there any problem with that? Any problem getting permission?
No, just kind of busy work.
Right, yeah.
And then the other part is that we have had to, in essence, code it ourselves. So they gave us the template so that, you know, if you have a photograph, you have to have the little bracket and this and photograph, AB, what size it is, chapter, you know, and then you'd have to have the coding for the caption, you know, so all of that stuff. So that took a lot of.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, it wasn't difficult, but it was just kind of tedious.
Yeah. How long did the process take from the beginning of, you know, making the decision to write the book to having it published and ready to go?
It will be total about a little over 2 years.
Yeah, so big commitment.
Took us about a year to write it. And then, so we signed the contract with Schiffer, I think it was last August. And September 28th is our published date.
All right. So it's coming up. So it should be, actually, when this goes live, it'll be about a month from now.
Right. And you can pre-order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop, which is the independent bookseller's site, and Books A Million are all, or Schiffer's website.
Right. And the title, again, is Contemporary Southern Vernacular, Creating Sustainable Houses for Hot, Humid Climates. So if you're looking to pre-purchase, that's the title that you need to search.
And if you're anywhere in our geographic area and willing to drive, we're going to have a big launch party in the fall. So just shoot us an email and we'll invite you.
Yeah. Well, send me information on that. Maybe Anne-Marie and I will come down and visit you.
Oh, good.
Yeah. That would be fun. Last question before my final question. I have one more question about the book. Do you encourage other architects to do the same?
Yes, I think it's one, it's part of the impetus too, was to be recognized as experts in hot, humid climate. So I think that we can say, well, we've written the book on it. So that's one thing that's really good.
Yeah.
And I think if you're doing it for a marketing piece, really think about who are your clientele and why you need to write that. I have a friend here in South Carolina, David Moore, who wrote a book on libraries because that was his specialty. And, you know, it's helped him tremendously advance his career in doing more libraries. So I think that that's important if, you know, for a marketing point of view is good. I mean, and I think something that is imparts knowledge to a different client sector is probably more valuable than just doing a monograph on your work.
Right, right, exactly. Something that teaches a specific topic to a specific audience.
Right. I mean, a monograph is great, but I don't think that that's what...
Yeah, it's a different tool.
It's a different tool, right.
Yeah.
But yes, I would definitely encourage people to do it. I mean, we talked about it for 10 or 15 years before we ever did it. You know, it's one of those things that you kind of just... okay, we're going to do it, and you have to stay on task to do it.
Yeah. Any words of warning? Any issues that if you could do it again, you would do it differently?
I'll see when it comes out. I don't know. I mean, that's...
Yes.
You know, I think there's a different model. Sometimes that you get a publisher before you really have written the book. So I don't know if that would be better or not. You would probably have your editor more involved in it as you progress. But
yeah.
It went pretty quickly because even though we signed the contract with Schiffer last August or so, we just got put in their, you know, path to move forward. So they didn't really start working on it till January or so. So it was pretty fast once they started formatting and editing and getting it all put together. Because it got sent out to the printers sometime in May.
And I said that it was going to be the last question, but I have one more question about the book.
Okay.
About writing the book. You wrote it together.
Uh-huh.
What was that process like? Was that a complicated process, or because you were already partnering on certain things in the business that it came a little easier?
I think it came easier because I did more of the heavy lifting on the writing and Michael did more of the illustrations. So it's like...
So much like the partnership in the business, you've divided and conquered.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's not like he didn't have any say-so in what was written.
Right, it was just, right. You were the lead on the writing and he was the lead on the design. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Well, that's excellent. I wish you luck.
Oh, thank you.
If you're in a southern climate, you should be buying this book. I'm going to go right now and pre-order.
If you're an architect that is up north and you have a project down here, you probably need it even more than architects.
Yes, exactly. Because we design and build differently down here.
Yeah.
Which I have learned since I've moved down here because I'm from New York. So it's a big shift for me. All right, final question. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I would say get involved in a professional organization. I'm partial to the AIA, but there are others out there because as a small architect, you can quite often it just gets too insular and this spreads your viewpoint. You make friends all over the country, all over the world. And you can share ideas and they're not competitors. So if you have problems, you know, like the AIA has the Small Firm Exchange, which is an excellent way to get, or we're involved with CRAN, which is the Custom Residential Architect Network. So you can find your group of people that will help you expand your business and grow your business and make life a lot of fun.
All right. Get involved, people.
Yeah.
Jane Frederick is her name. Frederick and Frederick is the firm. F-FArchitects.com is the website. Go check out the website. They do beautiful work. The book is called Contemporary Southern Vernacular, Creating Sustainable Houses for Hot, Humid Climates. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So you could just go to the show notes for this episode and there'll be a direct link to Amazon to pre-order the book. Jane, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Mark. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate you for taking the time and coming on the show, but I want to thank you also for your leadership and your advocacy for our profession, and not only for the profession at large, but specifically for small firms. The advocacy that you've had for small firms is important to me and important to our community. And so I thank you for your dedication to our profession and the work that you've done. And congratulations on the book. I'm excited to get a copy of it. I'm going to gift it to my wife, who is also an architect. And so lots of what you're talking about resonate with me and my wife. And so I'm looking forward to surprising her with it. So thank you for writing it. And thanks for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at the podcast.
Talk to you later.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember 3 words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season 1, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.